Our brains have evolved to make us good at communication. Communication is Homo sapiens' superpower. It is the thing that sets us apart from every other species and allowed us to build families and villages and towns. It means that I can learn something and I can pass it to you without you having to experience the same hardships I had to learn it. Different cultures definitely have different norms, but underlying them is the same basic impulse, which is the impulse is to connect, to have a real conversation, not to just, you know, talk about the weather, which is kind of boring.
Charles Duhigg is a best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's famous for his work on habits, productivity, and the science of human behavior. His insights offer a way to better connect with the people around us and understand why conversations work.
We're all born to be super communicators, and at various times, we are super communicators, right? There's always someone in our life. We know exactly what to say when we go into the meeting to win everyone over, or a friend calls and we know exactly what to say to them. But then at other times, it falls apart and we feel like we can't connect. And then the last thing that you can do for a hard conversation, there's two questions you should ask yourself before the conversation actually starts, which is,
I'm Erica Kohlberg, and you're listening to the Erica Taught Me podcast. Hi, it's Erica Kohlberg, and before we dive into today's podcast episode, I have an exciting announcement that can help you save an extra $1,000 without having to penny pinch or change your lifestyle. On Monday, I'm running my free 5-day savings challenge, where you'll discover simple and creative ways that you can save extra money every month. And whatever you want to do with that extra money is up to you. I'll just show you how to save it. The challenge is totally free to join. All you need to do is go to erica.com/go. Erica is with a K, and you can secure your spot. By the way, these strategies that you're going to discover can help you easily save money, whether you're a budgeting novice or a finance expert. And they're going to get better and better throughout the week. But I have to tell you, I'm so excited about this and don't want you to miss out. In November of last year, we ran a savings challenge and had over 200,000 people sign up. And on average, people saved $1,005 that month through what they learned in the challenge. That means our challengers collectively saved over $200 million. So trust me when I say you don't want to miss out on this one. And the deadline to sign up to be part of this free challenge is Sunday, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. So make sure you secure your spot and get free access today. Again, that's erica.com/go, erica.com/go. See you inside. So what makes some people better communicators?
I think what really is at the core of being a super communicator is showing someone that you want to connect with them. And that's actually harder than it sounds, right? Because there's certain skills or tools that we have that show people that we want to connect. And if we're not aware of them, we just assume that people know we want to connect with them. But the truth of the matter is, they don't know that we want that. They don't know that we're open and inviting the connection. And so sometimes when I talk about super communicators to sort of illustrate who they are, I'll ask people, and I'll ask you this. So if you were having a really, really bad day, and you wanted to call a friend who you know would make you feel better, just talking to them would, like, do you know who you would call?
Yes.
Yeah, who is it?
Shirley.
Shirley, okay. So Shirley. So for you, Shirley is a super communicator, and you're probably a super communicator back to her. Now, what does Shirley do that she, like, pops instantly into your mind as the person you want to call?
She's a really good listener. She's non-judgmental.
Okay.
And just makes me feel happy.
So, okay, I'm going to make some assumptions and you can tell me if I'm getting this wrong. When you say she's a really good listener, my guess is she's proving to you that she's listening. And you might not even be aware of it. You probably do the same thing back to her, right? She's probably, like, repeating back some things that you said kind of in her own way to make sure she understands it. She's asking follow-up questions. She's paying attention, but also to draw out more. And then she's paying close attention to what you're asking for, what you need from this conversation. So if she makes you happy, it's probably that she can intuit that you might be feeling a little bit down, so you might want a funny story, or you're feeling a little bit down and you want someone to commiserate with you, right? She's showing you again and again that she wants to connect with you. And at the end of the day, being a super communicator, it is not about how well or eloquently you say words, or that all of your ideas are perfectly formed. That's actually the opposite. A super communicator, someone who's a great communicator, is someone who shows you they want to connect with you. And there's just these like skills that we can learn to do that.
Well, it's funny because when I was starting to read the book, I really thought it was going to be about how to be more eloquent, but it's really the opposite. It's how to be a better listener, right?
That's exactly right. How to be, and it's interesting because when we say like eloquence, what we usually mean is like somebody who speaks like Shakespeare or Barack Obama, right? Like, but what eloquence actually is eloquence is speaking in a way that you understand what I'm trying to convey. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that means just being honest and vulnerable. Like my words might be totally jumbled. I might not say things exactly the right way, kind of like this conversation. I might like trip over my own. But if you understand what I'm saying because you intuit that I'm being honest and vulnerable and authentic with you, and then you reciprocate that, then that is eloquence. Mm-hmm. It might not look like eloquence when a printed transcript, but it is the truest form of eloquence because we're understanding each other.
And for people like Shirley, I feel like she intuitively has it. She's not trying to be a super communicator. She's just very good at it naturally. For people who are not so good at it, how do you become better?
So it's very interesting. So you can definitely become better. And my guess is that Shirley has thought about her conversations with you and has actually thought about how to be a good friend to you and probably you to her, right? Like this is, I mean, not all the time, but it's something that you think about. So what we know is that I don't think Shirley was probably actually born with this any more than anyone else was born with this because we're all born to be a fantastic communicators. We're all born to be super communicators. And at various times we are super communicators, right? There's always someone in our life. We know exactly what to say when we go into the meeting to win everyone over, or a friend calls and we know exactly what to say to them. But then at other times it falls apart and we feel like we can't connect. Our brains have evolved to make us good at communication. And that's because communication is Homo sapiens' superpower, right? Our ability to communicate like this, it is the thing that sets us apart from every other species and allowed us to build families and villages and towns. It means that I can learn something and I can pass it to you without you having to experience the same hardships I had mm-hmm. to learn it. And so we are all designed to be amazing communicators. We all have these instincts. But of course, our brains evolved in a very different time, right? It was like not only pre-internet, it was pre-phone, right? It was pre-being able to travel long distances or live beyond 40 years old. And so one of the things that we know is that in contemporary society, sometimes those instincts get muted. And so there's a series of skills that you can learn that basically let your instincts come out. And one of them is, and this is something you mentioned about Shirley, is asking questions. And in fact, there's one of the things we know is that consistent super communicators, people who can connect with almost anyone, they ask 10 to 20 times as many questions as the average person, which is a lot.
Wow.
And some of them are like questions you hardly even notice. Like, oh, like what'd you say next? Or, oh, that's interesting. What'd you think about that? Right, just to invite you in. But some of them are what's known as deep questions. And a deep question is something that asks about your values or your beliefs or your experiences, which can sound a little intimidating. And I'm wondering if Shirley does this to you.
Is it like a how do I feel about this type question?
That's exactly right. Instead of asking someone about the facts of their life, it's asking them how they feel about their life. So if you bump into someone who's a doctor, a deep question would be to say, like, instead of where do you practice medicine, would be something like, you know, what made you decide to go to medical school? Or like, what do you love about being a doctor? What's your favorite case? Those are questions that invite the other person to say something meaningful to them. And as a result, they'll say something actually authentic and possibly vulnerable.
And is it that you should start at different levels, like start at the where did you go to medicine first and then move down to the what made you get into this?
I mean, honestly, people feel uncomfortable if their first question is like, what are you most passionate about in life, right? But the truth of the matter is, actually, if you ask that, most people will be like, oh, let me tell you what I'm passionate about, right? So oftentimes we start a little bit more shallow for our own benefit because we feel awkward asking a very deep question. But there's a guy named Nicholas Epley at the University of Chicago who's done a lot of studying of deep questions. And he does this sort of thing with himself where ever so often he'll take a bus ride, he'll go and he'll sit next to a stranger and he'll start up a conversation with them. And his goal is that within three questions to get them talking about their dreams. So he usually says like, what do you do for a living? And someone's like, oh, I'm an accountant. Says, oh, did you always want to be an accountant? What was that? Like, what was that what you dreamed of as a kid? And, you know, the person is like, kind of like, oh, this guy's kind of interested. It's more than I expected on the bus, but sure. And he starts answering. So within two or three questions, they're at this person's hopes and dreams. So yeah. It's not hard to do. You just have to look for the opportunity.
I don't do it intentionally to become a better communicator, but I get really car sick. Yeah. So I always sit in the front of taxis or Ubers. And the taxi drivers in New York City hate this. It is very not what they expect. And some of them are so mad at me for sitting in the front that they just don't talk to me. But then some of these taxi drivers talk to me the whole time and we end up like crying together at the end.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how you can go from knowing nothing about someone to, if you're asking the right questions, really get deep into who they are.
And so those are moments of super communication. You are a super communicator at those moments because you're creating this environment. You're inviting the other person to share something with you. And what's interesting is we think about those moments as being unique, right? We think about like, oh, this is unusual. But actually, like, if you look at human psychology, we're built to have those moments. Like, those moments are supposed to be a portion of every single person's day. And we know that the more of those moments you have in your life, the happier and the healthier and the more successful you are. So it's a pleasant surprise when it happens, but it should be a pleasant unsurprise. It should be pleasant, something expected because we have the capacity for it and because we do find it, our brains are designed to crave that connection, which is why the taxi drivers like talking to you so much.
Yeah, it feels like a culturally American thing though. So yeah. My mom is from Japan, and in Japan, the thing that you always talk about with people is weather. So no matter who you meet, it's like, oh, the weather is so nice today, or it's been raining a lot.
Yeah.
And you don't really go that much deeper than that. It really has to stay that surface level.
Okay, so we went to Japan with my kids last summer, and I love Tokyo. And so we spent a bunch of time, and I talked to some researchers there. So when you do have real conversation, like if you're at a party, right, and you start by talking about the weather, like, tell me how it progresses from there. Like, what? Because you can't talk about the weather for 10 minutes, right? It's like, that's like 45 seconds worth of conversation.
I'm generalizing, but then it feels like you talk about work and what you do. And maybe then you get to who you are.
Yeah.
But there are so many levels that you have to get to. It's a very culturally not okay thing to go straight into what are your dreams and ambitions?
Yeah. So it's interesting. There's this experiment, again, Nick Apley does, where he brings a room full of people together and he assigns the strangers to talk to each other. And they have to ask and answer these questions. And the third question is, when's the last time you cried in front of another person? And it's easier to do because it's an experiment. You're being told to do this, right? It doesn't feel very awkward. So this experiment has been done by other people in lots of places. And they've done it in Japan as well. And what's interesting is that almost inevitably, when that question gets asked and answered in Japan, people don't talk about the last time they cried. They talk about a time that they saw their parents cry. And I think that what that suggests, and there's a lot of evidence to back this up, is that different cultures definitely have different norms, right? And different rules almost about what we feel comfortable with and what feels habitual. But underlying them is the same basic impulse, which is the impulse is to connect, to have a real conversation, not to just, you know, talk about the weather, which is kind of boring. But that oftentimes when we're in different settings, and this is also true across like a little bit gender differences and other differences, that when we're in a different setting, just being conscious of the slight difference in the norm means that it would feel totally uncomfortable at a party, I imagine, in Tokyo to ask you when's the last time you cried in front of another person. But it might actually be much more comfortable to say, like, have you ever seen your parents cry? That might not come off as the same kind of personal question. But what's important is that we recognize that the impulse is there. And
yeah.
We know how to think about it. We know how to look for opportunities.
So far what I'm getting to is that you have to go deeper with the questions that you do ask, talk about feelings rather than transactional questions. And then you have to be asking 10 to 20 times more questions than most people ask.
You don't have to ask that many questions. You definitely don't. You should not ask questions when it should not be an interrogation, right? And the other thing that's important is that even though super communicators are asking that many questions, and that's over a long time period, right? But the other thing that they're doing is that when someone is saying something real, when someone is saying something authentic, they're reciprocating with their own authenticity. So So if you just focus on asking the questions, then it will feel like an interrogation, right? We've all been in that conversation where someone just asks you question after question. Yeah. You're like, oh my God. So what a super communicator does though, is that they might ask a deep question. You know, how did you decide to become a doctor? Oh, my dad got sick when I was a kid and I decided I want to go to medical school. Oh, really? That's interesting. I went to law school because I had a brother who got arrested once and I thought it was totally unjust. So oftentimes super communicators, they'll answer the same question that they asked in order to sort of create that back and forth, to create that reciprocation. And that's really, really important because otherwise it feels like, if it feels one-sided, it doesn't feel like a real conversation.
Yeah, but I think we've all been there when someone is asking you a question and then they answer afterwards. And it's really, they asked you so that they would have the opportunity to answer.
Yeah, so this is called boomer asking, but okay. Like a boomerang. And you're exactly right. You don't want to do that. You don't want to be like, where'd you go on vacation? Because what you really want to be is like, oh, I went to the Maldives myself. That's interesting that you went to Disneyland. But I think that part of it is, if we're authentic with our question, then we're not just setting ourselves up. We're not just asking it so that we can answer it ourselves.
Yeah. How do I, as a podcast host, become better? Sometimes I do notice myself as the guest is speaking, I'll think of the next question and then try to like actively hold the next question in my head so I don't forget it.
Yeah.
What do I need to do?
Okay, so this is a really good question. Apart from being a podcast host, we often want to listen really closely, but we get into this trap where someone says something and we start like, we might rebut their argument in our head, right? Or we might like think about like, you know, I want this person to think I'm smart, so here's the next question I'm going to ask or something like that. So the question is, how do we trick ourselves into listening really, really closely? And luckily, the answer to this is also the same way that we prove to someone that we're listening to them, which is this technique called looping for understanding, which you've actually already done in this conversation. It has three steps. The first step is you ask a question, preferably a deep question. The second step is once you answer that question, I'm going to repeat back. My assignment for myself is to repeat back in my own words what you just said. The third step is I'm going to ask you if I got it right, which is essentially giving me permission to acknowledge that I've listened to you. And the reason why this is so powerful is because, first of all, particularly in hard conversations or tough conversations, we always suspect that the other person is not actually listening to us. They're just waiting their turn to speak. Mm-hmm. So this is a way of proving to you that I'm actually listening, which makes you more likely to listen to me. But it's also a way to hack my own brain, because if my assignment to myself is I have to listen closely enough to repeat back what you're saying, I can't get distracted. I won't let myself get distracted, right? So I think that's one of the things that super communicators do so well is, and it's hard in a podcast, right? Because you have like two jobs right now. One job is to have a conversation with me, and one job is like think about the listener and like come up with those smart questions for them. But in a conversation, your job is really only to be in the conversation. And so if you give up control of it and just listen, that's okay. That's actually a successful conversation.
You guys know that I love investing because you know that if your money is just sitting in a bank account, you're losing out to inflation every single year. That's why you invest it so that it grows for you without you having to put in any extra work. I've been using an investing app called Webull for almost 4 years, and I had them do something really special for my listeners. By using my link to sign up today, you can get between 6 to 12 fractional shares for free. All you need to do is open an account and deposit any amount, even a dollar, to claim your free shares. So just by depositing a dollar, you'll get between 6 to 12 free fractional shares. And if you're wondering what to actually invest in, we talk all about investing in episode 28, so go ahead and listen to that episode. To claim your free shares through my special link, just go to ericataughtme.com/invest or click the link in the show notes. And it's Erica with a K. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/invest.
And what do you think are some of the toughest conversations that people encounter? And then how can they use these skills to improve the success rate?
So in the book, we tell a couple of stories about really hard conversations. You know, there's this experiment that was done where they brought together a bunch of gun rights activists and gun control advocates. and trying to have conversations with them. There's a story about this CIA officer who is sent overseas for the first time to recruit spies and is like terrible, terrible at recruiting spies. And then there's conversations about things like race and gender. And at Netflix, we tell the story at Netflix of basically the company almost having this like civil war as they were trying to work through some issues over race. And I think the hardest conversations are the ones where we are anxious about having the conversation. We're going into it, we say if I could avoid this, I would, right? Like, I got to give this person this feedback and it's going to not be fun. Or I got to talk to my spouse about this thing. Or there's this thing that I want to ask about, but I'm really worried I'm going to say the wrong thing and I'm going to offend the other person. Mm. And so a couple of things that we can do to make those conversations better. And a lot of this comes from examining conversations about race. The first thing is, it's really helpful at the start of the conversation simply to acknowledge this is going to be an awkward conversation. I know that this is going to be hard to talk about, and I want to thank you for talking about it with me. And probably I'm going to say some things wrong, and I hope that you forgive me. And I promise you, if you say things wrong, I won't assume that you're trying to offend me. I'll understand. It's hard. It's hard to make the ideas come out of my mouth so well, right?
Yeah.
So if we just acknowledge that it's going to be awkward and that we might say the wrong things, that actually goes a long way to making the conversation better because it reduces the anxiety. Then the next thing that we can do is we can really put a premium on proving that we're listening. Because oftentimes when we are in a conflict conversation, when we disagree with someone, when it's something that it's hard to talk about, that is when we become most suspicious that the other person isn't listening. And so that looping for understanding I mentioned, in a casual conversation, you can make it kind of casual. What I hear you say is this, am I getting that right? But in a conflict conversation, you really want to say, okay, what I hear you saying is this and this and this. Did I understand you? Am I getting everything you're trying to tell me? Because what happens is that we have this instinct in our brain for reciprocal listening. If you prove to me that you're listening, I become much more likely to listen to you. And then the last thing that you can do for a hard conversation is you can kind of figure out, there's sort of two questions you should ask yourself before the conversation actually starts, which is, what do you actually want out of this conversation? And what do you think the other person wants? Because oftentimes we're like, look, I got to go tell my employee that they're doing a bad job. But that's not what you want out of the conversation. What you want out of the conversation is you want your employee to do a better job, or you want them to know that they're on thin ice. You want something besides just communicating information to them. And then once you know what you want, and that's going to really help you because it's going to help you make clear the goal of the conversation is not just to criticize you, it's to help you improve. Mm-hmm. You want to think about what does the employee want? If I'm going to give them some critical feedback, what they probably want is they want to know whether this is something that's permanently damaging to their career or just a blip. They probably want to know how to improve. They want to know whether this means that I sort of a judgment on their character versus a judgment on one project. Mm-hmm. And once I think about what they want out of the conversation, and they probably want a little bit of comfort, right? A little bit of me saying, I'm giving you some hard news, but I think you're worth it. If I'm thinking about what they want as much as what I want, then I'm probably going to have that conversation pretty differently, right? I'm probably going to come into it saying something look, I have some critical feedback to give you, but my goal in giving it to you is to help you get better, help you be more successful here. And I want you to know, this is feedback on this one project. It doesn't mean that I think you're a bad employee, but it means that I think there's some room for improvement. Mm. Think about how differently that conversation goes when you start it that way, as opposed to coming in and saying, I've got some critical feedback for you. Right. Yes. And all of a sudden everyone gets freaked out.
But how do you balance when you have to give critical feedback like that? How do you balance making them feel comfortable, but not giving them so much false hope? Maybe you are putting them on a 30-day performance plan where at the end of it, if they do not prove themselves, you need to...
Oh, I don't think you should give them any false hope. Mm-hmm. I think you should be authentic and honest.
But how do you give them that comfort that you mentioned?
Well, I think that what you can say is, You can say something true. If you're giving them 30 days, my guess is you do think that they have the ability to improve, right? And it might be that just you're giving them 30 days because that's what the law requires, right? But let's assume for a minute that you want to have an authentic conversation. Mm-hmm. I think being authentic and honest, coming in and saying to someone, look, I'm putting you on a 30-day improvement plan. And if things don't improve at the end of the 30 days, we're probably going to have to part ways. But the reason I have this improvement plan is because I actually think you can improve. Like, I think if you do this, that these problems will get resolved. I don't think you should give any false hope. You're not doing anyone any favors. And more importantly, the goal of a conversation is to understand each other. And if I'm not saying something authentic, I'm not really giving you a chance to understand me. I would even say, you know, the truth being told, and I've been in this situation myself with employees, if you're putting them on a 30-day improvement plan just because, like, that's the polite thing to do or what required by the law, but you don't think they can improve, I've actually found it's much better to say to folks, look, I'm putting you on a 30-day improvement plan. I'll be honest, I don't think this is going to work out, but I want to give you 30 days to, like, find an alternative. And people appreciate that. I mean, they might be a little pissed off in the moment, right? They might not want to have a conversation at that moment. But I think they appreciate that more than not being authentic.
With a lot of people becoming remote workers now, both as from the manager and the employee standpoint, what do you think people need to do differently?
I think we need to think very deliberately about what these different forms of communication, what their strengths and weaknesses are. So take Zoom. Sometimes we kind of pretend like a Zoom is like a face-to-face conversation, but it's not, right? There's certain strengths that it has. It means I can be at home and I can be relaxed, but there's weaknesses in that, like, if you're looking off to the side in a meeting, I know that you're still paying attention because there's nothing in the corner. But if you're looking off to the side on a Zoom, you might be like watching TV or doing an email. And so I think that what's really critical is just to be very deliberate. And when it comes to creating culture, when it comes to establishing culture and teaching other people about the culture, oftentimes when we used to get together in an office, that happened almost thoughtlessly, right? It happened through office gossip. It happened through being able to see each other. If we're remote, we have to be more deliberate about it. We have to say things like, here's our values and here's how we do things. And here, if someone gets fired, you have to sort of explain why they got fired, because back in the old days, everyone would tell each other why they got fired. But now it just seems like something that comes out of nowhere. And so I think the key is these new forms of communication are powerful and they're not bad, but we have to think about their strengths and their weaknesses and accommodate them.
If you had to predict, a lot of companies are going all remote. A lot of them are doubling down on all in person. The success rate of those 10 years from now, what do you think?
I think the determinant of whether it's going to be successful or not successful is not whether you're remote or in person. I think a lot of it has to do with how good your leadership is. And honestly, in some cases, what industry you're in. Mm. Like when I talk to my friends who are software entrepreneurs, they love remote work because basically they were like, look, we were kind of all remote in the same office previously, and now I can hire someone who lives in Nebraska. So whereas when I talk to my friends in banking, they're like, this is the worst because you have to train the junior investment banker by like letting them see you talk to the client. So I don't think there's one solution that is better than the other. I think it's entirely dependent on leaders thinking deeply about which solution is right for them in different times.
What do you do when you are doing everything right? So you are listening, you've gone in with the intentions of what is the outcome I want, but the conversation just is not going the way you want it to go.
So everything in Super Communicators that I write about are a set of tools that you can use. And the truth of the matter is that, like, tools depend as much on the person who's carrying them and the material that they're working upon as anything else. You can use an axe to build a house, or you can use an axe to chop someone's head off, right? Just because the tool exists doesn't mean it's always going to be good. And sometimes you try and build a house and you chop down a bunch of trees and the trees are rotten. Like, you can't build the house with those trees. I don't know that there's a surefire magic way to make a conversation go well when the other person doesn't want to have a conversation, right? Sometimes someone is just furious and angry, and they say they want to have a conversation and they don't. They want to yell at us. And in those situations, the best thing often we can do is just to listen and sort of say, like, okay, like bring it on. I want to hear what you're saying. And then a day or two later, go back and actually have the conversation.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, if a conversation is going poorly, it's well worth taking a break and saying, and just taking some time and thinking to yourself, like, why is it going poorly? Like, what's happening in this dynamic that's making it hard for us to understand each other? And oftentimes, at least I've found with my wife, when we have fights, that helps.
If you're listening, let me guess. You have a passcode on your phone. And let me take another wild guess and say that you have a password on your computer. But why are so many of us okay just being completely unprotected online? We have no idea who has all our personal information online and whether it's the good guys or the bad guys who might be selling your information or worse. We're talking spammers, telemarketers, robocallers, people who want to know more about you and even where you live. My sister had her data leaked online, and because of that, her identity was stolen. And it was a nightmare to deal with. We had to lock down all her credit cards just for starters. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Aura, a sponsor of this episode. Aura can identify data brokers exposing your info and submit opt-out requests on your behalf. When I discovered it, I knew I had to try it out, just to see if my information had been leaked online, which they let me see instantly after I signed up. And get this, for my audience, they're offering a free 14-day trial so you can see if your personal information has been leaked online. To find out now, go to ericataughtme.com/aura to claim your free 14-day trial. Erica with a K, and Aura is spelled A-U-R-A. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/aura, and I'll also leave the link in the show notes. I recently went on an anniversary getaway with the husband and it was beautiful. Here's everything I got for free. We got free business class tickets for an international flight, which meant, yep, you guessed it, I got free access to the lounge where we could kick things off with a glass of champagne. Then we got a free stay at a 5-star hotel where we could relax and go to the beach. Okay, so now I'm sure you're wondering how I got it for free, and you know I don't gatekeep, so here's the insider knowledge you need to know. I did it by signing up for a free Bilt credit card. Bilt is a credit card that lets you earn points just for paying your rent, and there's no extra fee. And when I say free, I mean free. There's no annual fee for the credit card, and they don't charge a transaction fee for paying your rent with the card. You'll also earn 2 times the points on travel and 3 times the points on dining. Once you get your points, you can transfer them to travel partners like airlines and hotels to then get the free business class flights or 5-star hotels like I did. To sign up for this card, go to ericataughtme.com/built. Erica is with a K and built is B-I-L-T. Or to make it easier, go to the link in the show notes. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/built.
What is the dynamic when you as a super communicator get into an argument?
So part of the reason I wrote Super Communicators was because I got into this bad pattern where I would come home from like a long, hard day at work, and I would like start complaining about my boss or my coworkers. And Liz, my wife, who's wonderful, very reasonably would offer some like practical advice, like, why don't you take your boss out to lunch and you guys can get to know each other a little bit better. And instead of being able to hear her, I would get even more upset. And I would be like, why aren't you like listening to me and taking my side? You should be outraged on my behalf. And then she would get upset because I was attacking her for giving me good advice. And so I went to these researchers and I asked them, like, why is this happening? Like, what am I doing wrong here that this keeps happening? And they said, well, so we're living through this golden age of understanding communication. Because of advances in data collection and neural imaging, we kind of know what happens in our brains now. And they said, one of the big things that we've learned is we tend to think of a discussion as being about one thing, right? We're talking about my day, or we're talking about our kids' grades or something like that, or we're going to go on vacation. But actually, every discussion is made up of different kinds of conversations. And most of those kinds of conversations, they fall into one of three buckets. There's practical discussions where we're talking about making plans or solving problems. Then there's emotional conversations where I tell you how I feel and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. And then there's social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other and the social identities that matter to us. The thing that we've learned, all three of those conversations are legitimate conversations. And often in a discussion, all three of them will pop up. Mm-hmm. But if you're not having the same kind of conversation at the same time, you can't really hear each other. So when I was coming home from work, I was having an emotional conversation and my wife was responding with a practical conversation. And those are both super legitimate, but because they weren't the same conversation at the same moment, we were having trouble connecting. So now when I come home and I complain about work, Liz will often say, you know, do you want me to help you think up solutions to this? Or do you just want to vent and get this off your chest?
That's so interesting. If I think back to every argument I've had or every frustration I've had in conversations with my husband, I think it is because we are having two different conversations. When I'm having an emotional conversation, I really want a place to vent, but I also want him to ask me the right questions for me to figure out the solution. I don't want to be told the solution. Exactly. If I'm told the solution, it doesn't feel like my own idea, therefore I'm not going to do it. And in fact, I might rebel against it.
That's exactly. And so in that emotional conversation, when I'm empathizing, that does not mean I just say like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, oh, is that how you feel? Like, it means that I'm also participating. I'm asking you questions. I'm perhaps sharing some of my own experiences if it doesn't steal the spotlight, but helps kind of engage in reciprocity. But you're exactly right. But the questions I'm asking, instead of the question being, oh, if you tried this, do you think that it would go better? It might be a question like, why do you think that made you so angry? Mm-hmm. Right. I'm asking you about your emotions, about your feelings, because you're having an emotional conversation. In a neurological perspective, what's happening is that when we have an emotional conversation, we're using sort of the deep structures in our brain. When we're having a practical discussion, is we're using much more of the prefrontal cortex, which is right behind the forehead. And then a social conversation takes advantage of what's known as a distributed network. And so what's interesting is that if you're having an emotional conversation, kind of using your amygdala and other parts of your brain, and suddenly I ask you all these practical questions, it feels like I'm pulling you out of where you are, right? It feels like I'm not actually listening to you because I'm asking you to think completely differently than you're thinking right now.
This is so good. I think it's clicking.
Yeah.
One thing I want clarity on is the social conversations. I'm not sure I quite understand what classifies a social conversation.
So a social conversation, so office gossip is a social conversation.
Got it. Okay.
Talking about someone else, if we were talking about your husband, and we weren't talking about your husband in context of how you feel about your husband, but we're sort of talking about like, what's your husband like? And like, oh, how would he see the situation? That's often a social conversation. So when we're talking about other people, when we're using this default network to sort of visualize and think about other people, that's a social conversation. But then there's another aspect of social conversations, which are social identities, that coming into this conversation, we are aware of our similarities and we are aware of our differences. And some of them, it's not even worth acknowledging, right? But some of them matter. Like if we were talking about issues of gender, the fact that you're a woman and I'm a man is actually really important and interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's a social conversation because you are aware of that society sees women differently. And I'm aware that society sees men differently. And that has some influence on how we have this conversation, particularly because like we might want to explain to each other how we feel like we conform to society, but also how we don't. That's an important aspect of understanding.
So is it external versus internal? Like, for example, I can give you internal perspective about how it is like being a woman, right, but I cannot give you internal perspective how it is to be a man. So that makes it social?
A little bit. So the external internal is a good distinction because when we're talking about external individuals or external identities, social identities, it's usually a social conversation. And a social conversation oftentimes is improved by acknowledging our similarities and our differences. And oftentimes we acknowledge the similarities, right? And we pretend the differences don't exist. Mm-hmm. We say things like, oh, we both went to the same high school. Like, that's amazing, right? But that conversation becomes more real if I say, oh, we both went to the same high school. But you know, you went to college and I didn't. I wonder, like, what was it like? Like, do you think, what was your high school experience like that took you to a different place? Or even, we both went to the same high school And like, I was in the drama club and I remember you were a jock. And like, what was it like being on the football team? That acknowledgement of the difference actually invites the other person to share something meaningful about themselves.
So can one conversation be in all three categories? So for example, we have a political discussion.
Right.
And we are on opposite sides of the spectrum. And I'm talking about my political views. You're talking about yours. That seems social. But then we actually talk about how it emotionally impacts us. Absolutely. I am of this political view because I had an experience where my dad did this X, Y, and Z. And that's why I became this political view. But then it could become practical because then maybe we're like, okay, well, what should we do?
For?
Who are you
going
to vote for? No. So does that happen quite often?
Every conversation has all three components.
Oh.
Every real conversation. It's not that you start in the emotional and you stick in the emotional the whole time. It's that we might start emotional. And then once we're aligned, we might move to the practical and then the social and then back to the emotional. But the point is that we're moving together. Mm-hmm. And politics is a great example of this, right? Because you're exactly right. Oftentimes politics starts as a social conversation, right? Oh, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat. So this is something. And then very often it becomes emotional without either person recognizing or acknowledging. Like why do you like that guy? Why are you going to vote for that guy? Well, like, I'm going to vote for that guy because I'm kind of like pissed off. I feel like the elites have like taken over the nation. Okay, now we're not having a practical conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We might be having an emotional conversation about your anger. We might be having a social conversation about how there is this group, the elites, that you feel like has betrayed the nation. If I'm aware of the fact that we are changing from one conversation to the other, and I can match you, what's known in psychology as the matching principle, having the same kind of conversation at the same time, that conversation is going to go so much better. Because if you bring up something emotional, mm-hmm. I'm really, really angry about where the nation is. And I stay in that practical mindset. And I'm like, well, you know, crime went down under my guy and went up under your guy. You're going to be like, screw you.
Yeah.
Like, that argument isn't going to be persuasive.
Yeah.
You're not looking for that kind of conversation.
So you have to be very fluid and move through it with them.
So what you have to do is you have to sort of ask yourself a little bit, what kind of conversation is happening here? And oftentimes asking a deep question will reveal that, right? And then just both matching the other person, but also inviting them to match you, right? So let's say we were talking about politics and you're talking about how angry you are. And I match you and I say, like, I totally understand. Like, I'm angry about different things, but I am really angry that, like, you're angry because of the elites and I'm angry because reproductive rights have been taken away from my daughter. So I think we have this anger in common. Like, we're both dissatisfied. Then if you do want to switch, sometimes you can just ask permission and say, you know, is it okay? Like, could I propose a potential, like, solution? Like,
mm-hmm.
like, I wish that there was a candidate who embodied both of our perspectives. So I'm kind of asking your permission to shift from an emotional conversation to a practical conversation. Or I can just invite you by saying, like, we're both angry. We talk a little bit about that and say, like, I'll tell you how I'm trying to deal with my anger. I'm trying to deal with my anger by volunteering on the weekends. Like, do you volunteer with anyone? And like moving it to a practical conversation that way.
Mm.
But the point is, I'm kind of paying attention, right? Like, this is what super communicators ultimately do. They do two things. They just think half an inch deeper about their conversation. Like, they just pay a little bit more attention, and mm-hmm. it's not hard. Our brains are designed to do this. And then number two, they show you that they want to connect with you. They don't want to convince you of anything. They don't want to prove to you that they're smart, that you should like them, that you're dumb. They just want to connect.
I'm still a little skeptical.
Okay.
So this takes me all the way back to the question about Shirley. It feels like super communicators is very much tied to emotional intelligence. And I believe that some people are just naturally more emotionally intelligent than others. And therefore, those who are more emotionally intelligent are more likely to become better super communicators. I'm not sure I understand how someone can train themselves to become a super communicator.
So I'll tell you what the science says.
Okay.
The science says, nobody is naturally more emotionally intelligent than anyone else. A guy named Peter Salovey at Yale University was the first person to coin the phrase emotional intelligence. And that was back in the 1980s. And since then, there has been literally thousands of studies trying to figure out if certain personality types, if certain upbringings make you more or less prone to emotional intelligence. And the answer is no. You can absolutely train emotional intelligence. the key to training emotional intelligence is that the person has to want to be emotionally intelligent. Mm. So Shirley, for instance, if Shirley did not want to be your friend and did not want to be a good friend, it would not matter how naturally good she is, right, at talking to you or empathizing. Emotional intelligence is about wanting to recognize what the other person is feeling and to reciprocate that. Mm-hmm. And so it's absolutely something that can be learned. And just to give you an example, when they've done studies of consistent super communicators, people who like can connect with anyone, before I went into this, I assumed that super communicators would be like super charismatic or super outgoing extroverts. Turns out that's not true at all. Basically, there's a completely normal distribution across society of who is a super communicator and who isn't. Oh. Introverts and extroverts.
I would have thought more introverts. The better super communicators I know are introverts.
That's interesting. So a lot of people think extroverts, but it actually turns out that that doesn't matter. Hmm. What they often find is that when they ask them about communication, and these are people who are great communicators, they say things like, oh, there was a period in my life when I was really bad at communication, or I had to think about it a lot. Like, I had real trouble making friends in high school. So I had to like kind of study how kids talk to each other. Or my parents got divorced and I was the peacemaker between them. So I had to learn how to have these conversations that didn't make everyone angry. And it's that thinking just half an inch deeper that makes them a super communicator. And so let me ask about Shirley. So is there like, if I was to ask Shirley if there's ever been a time in her life when she was bad at communication or it didn't go as well as she was hoping, what would she say?
I don't know the answer, actually.
Okay. I mean, my guess is that, and again, you can ask her and tell me if I'm right. My guess is she would be able to tell you like a time that she really wanted to connect with someone and it just didn't happen. And that still feels bad about it and she thinks about it. And something like that prompted her to think more deeply about her conversations, about how she communicates with other people. And my guess is, and this is probably true for your conversations with her as well, that you guys probably reflect on your conversations after they're over. You probably remember things she said. You think about things to tell her. You're getting deeper into how you connect and relate to each other. And that's what makes that connection become real.
So I know that when I need to have a difficult conversation, I actually usually will write out the email first. I never send it, but it's much easier for me to process my thoughts in writing and then maybe have that conversation in person.
Yeah.
Should everyone do that? Or are there certain people where they're not processing their thoughts like in writing first?
So I'll tell you what the research says.
Okay.
Two things. The first is, it depends what your habit is. So if you're in the habit of thinking by typing, right, of wanting to take an idea and then you edit it a little bit and you're not sure exactly what you want to say until you've gotten it out, if that's your habit, then that's totally fine. Now, there are some people, and that's me. I love like writing. There are some people who are in a different habit. And what, like one of my sons does not like writing, does not like reading. But he's really good at, in a conversation, going silent for a couple of seconds and thinking about what he wants to say. So the question is, what's most comfortable to you? And that's totally fine to do what's most comfortable. Now, that being said, there are some interesting studies that look at what happens when we do force ourselves to think before a conversation. And one of the best ones is this one that was done by professors at Harvard Business School. They told students, you're going to have a conversation with a stranger, which is like the most anxiety-producing thing on the face of the planet, right? It'll freak people out more than anything else. And they said, before you start this conversation with a stranger, take 10 seconds and write down three things. Write down three topics you want to discuss. And they can be dumb topics, like last night's game and where are you going this weekend and did you see this movie? And so they did this. And some of them, they wrote it down. Some of them, they told them, just think of these three topics. And then they said, okay, now go have your conversations. And people like would stick that piece of paper in their pocket and they would go have the conversations. And those topics almost never came up in the conversations. But everyone said afterwards that the conversations went so much better than they expected, in part because they were so much less anxious. They felt more confident because like if there was an awkward silence, they had something to fall back on. So I don't know that it matters if you write it out or if you just take a couple of minutes to think to yourself. Whatever your system, whatever your habit for processing your ideas and your thoughts are, it's great to use that. The point is, though, that if you spend just even 10 seconds before a conversation thinking about what you want out of that conversation, what you want to say, what you think the other person wants out of that conversation is going to go better. And is that what is that happening when you write those emails, you think?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. I have my topics and I have what I want to get out and what the outcome I want to get out.
There's this idea in psychology about how accurate we are at forecasting what we like and what we dislike. And that one of the predictable irrationalities of human beings is that we're sometimes bad at this accuracy. We predict something, we're going to enjoy something and we don't. We're going to underpredict how much we'll enjoy something else. And a big part of life, I think, is exposing ourselves to experiences that are accuracy becomes much more aligned with reality. But the only way you do that is by conducting experiments. And some of those experiments have to fail, right? Some of the conversations you have with strangers will have to be bad conversations for you to walk away and say, like, you know what? That was bad, but that wasn't like the end of the world.
I think what I'm really happy about is I came into this with preconceived notions about what a super communicator was. And I really thought that a super communicator was someone who was just naturally better at it. Now I'm understanding that it's not that super communicators have read the book Super Communicator and they've studied this. It's just maybe they think about it in a different way as how can I be a better friend? Or how can I be better at my sales job? Or how can I be better at building relationships? So that's interesting. I can see that being valid.
Yeah.
One question for you is, what is something that you had a misconception about around communication?
So the biggest surprise for me is this. Number one is I assumed that being a super communicator would be exhausting. Like I have friends who like they walk into like a bodega or like a gas station and they're like actually having a real conversation with the person behind the counter. And I just think to myself, like, oh my God, where do you get the energy for this, man? Like, but the truth of the matter is, again, because our brains have evolved to be great at communication, when we connect with someone, it doesn't actually consume energy, it generates it. So the people you know who are super communicators, when Shirley talks to you, even when she feels more energetic after that conversation than before. Same as you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I shied away from some aspects of connection because I thought that they would be taxing. And what I've learned is it's exactly the opposite. It's actually easier to connect with someone than it is to like kind of maintain our distance. And that does not mean you have to have conversations with everyone. Sometimes you get in a taxi and you just want to like check your email or zone out, and that's totally fine. But when you do want to have a conversation, going into it, know that like it's not actually going to be this thing that costs you a lot. It's going to be this thing that helps rejuvenate you a little bit.
Question there, okay. Though, because one thing I've done is analyzed who I'm hanging out with and whether the conversations and the relationship I have with them is energizing or draining.
Okay.
And there are certainly people who were in my circle where those conversations were draining.
Yeah.
What's gone wrong there?
Let me ask something about those conversations. If you bring up something that you're going through, do they ask you questions about it? Or do they bring up something that they're going through and kind of pretend that they're the same?
They bring up something that they're going through. They were not good communicators.
They're not actually matching you. What they're doing is they're basically stealing your spotlight.
Yeah.
Like they're using what you say as an excuse to talk about themselves. And that's completely draining because like you offer something to them and instead of accepting the offering and reciprocating, what they do is they take the offer and they're like, I'm just going to eat this and then like make it something all about me. So I think that's probably what happens. People can pretend to be super communicators without actually being super communicators, right? Like again, these are just tools that people can learn. But undergirding them is this question, do you actually want to connect with this person? Are you showing them that you want to connect with them? Or are you just using what they're telling you as an excuse to talk about yourself?
And so those people that you do identify are draining you, are you saying it is okay to cut them out?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's absolutely okay to cut them out. It is absolutely okay not to have a conversation with someone. Like there are times, and by the way, Sometimes my kids come up and I say to them, I want to have a conversation with you about your rooms. And I don't actually want to have a conversation with them about their rooms. I just want them to go clean their rooms, right? That's totally fine. The point of super communicators is not that we have to have conversations all the time. It's that when we want to have a conversation, when we want to connect with someone, that we have these tools available to us. Because, and you know this, and I do, a great conversation can feel amazing, right? The right conversation at the right moment can change everything. And so having those tools means that we're prepared for that instead of just hoping that it happens.
First of all, thank you so much. I have loved this. Oh. I have been a big fan of your Power of Habit book for many, many years. And I'm so excited for people to read Super Communicators. The podcast is called Erica Taught Me, but really today is all about Charles Taught Me. So what do you want people to walk away saying, Charles taught me this?
That is a great question. Here's the thing that the reason I wrote this book and that I hope people carry away from it. There's a study that was done at Harvard that's still going on called the Harvard Study of Adult Development. It's been going on for almost 100 years. They followed thousands of people around. They've tried to figure out what makes people healthier and happier and more successful at age 65. Success is however you define it. What makes people more happy and healthy and successful at age 65? And they found that the only thing that sort of predicates that, that forecasts that, is having at least a handful of close relationships at age 45, which of course means you've had them for longer, right? You've been talking to Shirley a lot longer than just meeting her at 45. And the reason why I think that's so important is because having real relationships with other people makes us literally healthier. It makes us happier. It opens us to opportunities that we might not see otherwise. And the way that we have those relationships is usually through conversations, right? It's through calling someone, even if you haven't talked to them in 6 months or 12 months or 18 months, calling them up and saying like, hey, what's up with you? And setting aside 2 hours. And you know, the first 10 minutes is going to be kind of awkward as you get updated on each other's life, but then letting yourself get into the flow and really connecting with this person. That is what I hope people carry away from our conversation and from the book.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you've enjoyed the episode, please take a moment to leave a review. It really helps support what we're doing. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday on a brand new episode of Erica Taught Me.